Welcome to Straight Talk for Real Life, produced by Hewlett-Packard Enterprise. Today we're talking about something I think we all probably could use a little more of, optimism. I don't mean the just think positive kind or pretending everything's fine when it's not kind, but the real kind that's grounded in science. It's something that you can actually learn and practice, and it turns out it's more powerful in our lives and relationships than most of us realize.
When we look at the science of optimism, we see head-to-toe benefits. First of all, optimists live longer. They live 10 to 15% longer, and they enjoy what we call exceptional longevity. Also, we see 30% reduction in heart attacks and strokes, but also making more money as a result of being optimistic.
So whether you're naturally upbeat or a bit of a skeptic, this episode has something for you. Stick around and let's explore how you can train your brain to see the good even when things aren't always so great. The purpose of this podcast is to foster discussion, not to provide advice. The information shared should never be used as an alternative to obtaining personalized advice from a healthcare professional, and listeners should seek such advice independently if they have any questions related to their physical or mental health. This podcast hosts different viewpoints, and the opinions of the speakers do not necessarily reflect the views of HPE. Hello and welcome to Straight Talk for Real Life. My name is Bob Peacock. Today we're joined by one of the leading voices in mental health, Dr. Sue Varma. If you're listening to us from the U.S., you may have seen her on the Today Show, CBS Mornings, or Good Morning America. Dr. Varma is on a mission to redefine optimism, not as wishful thinking, but as a practical, science-based skill we can all learn. In a world that can often feel heavy with negativity, Dr. Varma's message is clear. Optimism isn't about ignoring reality. It's about building resilience. Dr. Varma brings deep expertise to the table. She was the founding medical director for the 9/11 mental health program at NYU, where she worked with both civilian and first responders after the attack on September 11, 2001. She's also a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry and a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association. And she's also the author of the best-selling book, Practical Optimism, the Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being. Dr. Varma, welcome to Straight Talk for Real Life.
Thank you so much, Bob. What a lovely introduction. I'm so excited to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you. I read your book and really enjoyed it. It's full of great stories and exercises, and I'm excited to have our audience get to know you and learn about your program for themselves. We all have negative thoughts, right? And self-talk from time to time, but we hear the expression, some people are just born optimists. Is there such a thing? Is there a gene that some people are just born with?
Yes, great question, Bob. There absolutely is a gene. And it's interesting because, you know, for so many years, I always heard that somebody would say, you know, yes, I'm a little negative, but, you know, I was just born this way. Or, you know, what can I do? I just happen to see the glass as half empty, you know, as opposed to half full. There's a gene that codes for optimism, and it's called the oxytocin receptor gene. And, you know, many people are familiar with oxytocin as the cuddle hormone, the bonding hormone,
right.
Part of our sexual health. And really what it codes for is optimism, but only 25% of us are born this way, to see the glass as half full. And what I learned is that while 75% of us may have possibly a genetic predisposition to being negative or pessimistic or cynical, we all have the ability to learn the skills that the optimists are genetically born with. So I always say that, you know, optimists are born, but practical optimists are made.
Right. In reading your book, I learned that a practical optimist isn't someone who just smiles all the time and pretends that all's well with the world. You wrote, and I love this quote, "The pessimist complains about the wind, the optimist expects it to change, and the realist or the practical optimist adjusts the sails." So there's actually a difference between an optimist and a practical optimist. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. And I think of optimism as, you know, a very important mindset, but that's all it is at the end of the day. It's just a mindset that is going to help you live longer, be healthier, all those wonderful things if you're naturally born with it. But it is a mindset, and as a result of that, it's only one part of the equation, because our mindset isn't going to get anything done, right? It's the fact that practical optimism brings in a skill set, a tool set, and an action set. And that is where it differs, because a lot of people may even have what we call extreme optimism, blind optimism, or something called the ostrich effect, where you're burying your head in the sand and you're like, yeah, those problems, they don't exist. They're going to go away. There's a level of denial when you look at the extreme end of optimism. So we don't want either. We don't want either extreme optimism, nor do we want extreme pessimism. And believe it or not, Bob, there are benefits to pessimism that people don't know about. And, you know, there's this quote that I love, you know, that optimists build the planes, but pessimists build the parachutes. So clearly we need both.
Right. Well, why should we learn to be practical optimists? What are some of the benefits?
You know, when we look at the science of optimism, whether you're born with it, whether you're able to train your brain to be this way, we see head-to-toe benefits. First of all, optimists live longer. They live 10 to 15% longer, and they enjoy what we call exceptional longevity. And the first person that comes to my mind whenever I talk about exceptional longevity is my dad, and I talk about him in the book. And he literally looks and acts 15 years younger, and luckily, knock on wood, you know, in healthy and in great shape, and partly because he prioritizes certain things that optimists do. You know, some of it he's had to learn along the way, and some of it comes natural to him. But living longer, but not just living longer in good health, right? So a lot of us are living longer, and we see longer lifespan, but we know that a lot of people, particularly women, are spending the last decade of their life in poor health. So what benefit is it to live longer if you're going to be suffering, right? Dementia, cognitive decline, decline in muscle mass, loneliness, cardiovascular health. So not only are you living longer, but you're living longer in good health. That's one main benefit. Also, we see 30% reduction in heart attacks and strokes as a result of being optimistic. These folks are more likely to take care of their health, from mental health to dental health. So that partly explains why they have better health. They go to their annual visits. They don't smoke. They even are more likely to wear seat belts, optimists, right? And they don't smoke. They exercise. So there's a variety of reasons why, and health habits is only one part of it. So not only are you living longer in good health, less cardiovascular and stroke risk, but also making more money. Harvard Business Review talked about a few studies where people who were optimists were more likely to get promoted and have a raise of like 40% more in the next year. So we know that optimists it affects every aspect of your life, not to mention happier and longer and stronger bonds, whether it be marriage or supportive friendships.
So important.
Yeah, it's literally, I think of it as the optimism as the gift that keeps on giving.
Right. Well, your book, Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being, is filled with a lot of helpful science-based advice and exercises that can help anyone develop the skills needed to become a practical optimist. But this isn't a crash course or a quick fix. It's a wellness approach for life that takes some practice. Is that right?
Yes, yes. And, you know, some days it's a 5-minute practice. You know, some days it might be a little bit longer. And it just starts with intentionality. So, you know, a lot of people ask me, I've got a pessimist in my life, and, you know, what do I do? And, you know, look, it didn't take them, you know, they didn't become pessimistic overnight. They were either born that way or a lot of things happened to them. And, you know, that is the nature of the work that I do, right? Like, I work with people in the darkest of times. Right. And, you know, I remember one time having a conversation with someone who was inviting me to come speak on a TV program. And I said, you know, just so you know, I'm not a life coach, right? And I love my life coach friends. But there's something unique about, you know, as a psychiatrist, sometimes finding someone, you know, being by the bedside of someone who maybe didn't want to live the day before, you know, and something happened and they got brought into the hospital. So I say this, you know, because most people are listening may not be able to relate or identify. But what I'm saying is that this is an approach that will help you through your darkest of days. But even when you're feeling light, you know, it'll say, all right, you're doing well, but, you know, maybe there are places you want to make adjustments for. So regardless of where you are in your journey of well-being, of happiness, I think of this approach as a friend, you know, that is with you, that says, yes, there's some work involved, but really all you need to do is to just show up with intentionality of, I get it, mindset, a positive mindset can make my life better. And what are some things that I can do? Simple things. And, you know, you can approach this as a philosophical perspective and sort of more intellectual and engage with it on that level, or literally just tell me what I got to do, doc. Cause a lot of my patients are like, yeah, that's nice. I love the theory. I don't have time for it, but like I got 30 minutes. I got 5 minutes. What do you got for me? So I'm all about the practical tips, because I realized at the end, after working with thousands of people over the last 20 years, you know, I've done thousands of interviews, and I realized, you know, a lot of them, you have 5 minutes and they're like, okay, great. What are you going to, in 5 minutes, you have to explain the problem, you know, and also give tons of solutions that are going to change people's lives. So I've learned that people want practical tips at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And you probably learned and experienced a lot about the power of optimism when working with the 9/11 survivors, as well as patients during COVID pandemic. Was there a moment or a patient that really shaped your approach to using optimism as a tool?
Yes, definitely. You know, and there were so many, because I was fascinated, impressed, and, you know, I'm a New Yorker, so to see, you know, to be experiencing, you know, firsthand what everyone else is going through, you know, there were really two moments in history where doctor and patient are going through the same things. And I want to say it was like 9/11 and then COVID, and separated by almost, you know, 20 years. It's, you know, these events are great equalizers, and we all kind of are in the same thing together. But there was one patient I remember who, interestingly, was not part of our 9/11 program. So, you know, it was a screening program initially before I came, where people would get screened for mental health evaluation. So they would give questionnaires about anxiety, depression, PTSD, substance abuse, domestic violence. They would all get also get medical questionnaires about asthma and GI problems. You know, a lot of the folks that I was working with, were first responders, folks involved with cleanup, rescue, recovery, but then also residents and employees who were working and living in the area. And so you saw people from all walks of life, and, you know, who really experienced great tragedy, whether it be personal tragedy, loss of loved ones, injuries, physical injuries, getting trampled on, witnessing people jumping from the buildings. I mean, the most horrific things that a person can imagine and go through. This is what these folks went through. And there was one woman in particular who experienced all of what I just mentioned. And she was working in an accounting firm in the North Tower and got trampled on, you know, didn't have shoes at some point, and walking barefoot and miles, and didn't know if any of her colleagues or family members who were down there that day were still alive. And I remember her going through the worst of the circumstances, and somehow she never met criteria for anxiety or depression to make it into our program for treatment. And so when I came, we had started the treatment program, and I would always see her in the hallways, though. And, you know, I changed her name. She goes by Teresa now, and I talk about her to respect her privacy. And I would see her in the hallways, and she would be there accompanying other patients to their appointments. I would see her at community meetings. She was advocating for rights of the people who were living there and helping with trying to get funding. So I said to her one day, I said, you know, in Spanish, because I always love to practice whenever possible with her, I said, Teresa, ¿cuál es su secreto? What is your secret? And, you know, she smiled at me and she's like, mi propósito, my purpose. And I was like, wow, you know, that's when it hit me that sometimes the difference between getting sucked into dark times, you know, depression, anxiety, PTSD, you know, not to say that those who experienced it was their fault or that they caused it upon themselves, not at all, you know. But it was interesting to me that this woman had somehow behaviorally made a choice, right? She may be experiencing all of the things emotionally that everyone else did, but she made a choice, and I'm going to get up and I'm going to pretend, if for now, if I need to, that I am fine. And I am going to put that energy that normally we end up, when you're depressed, you end up ruminating, you end up going inward. I'm going to take that energy and flip it and put it to good use, you know, turning, as they say, pain into purpose. And that's what she did by being of such instrumental use to other people. And so that is when I learned my first lesson in resilience, and I would learn many. But I learned that they're key components of resilience, and altruism is one of them. Social support is another. So she was giving social support. She was receiving it by helping other people. They were so grateful to her. She became known as a sort of community leader that people would rely on. And that is when I learned also, I went deep into the literature, that optimism is also a key feature of resilience that no one would talk about and nobody cared about, because they were like, A, that's woo-woo thinking, you know, and B, you're either born with it or you're not. So it wasn't seen as a scientific construct. And then fast forward, you know, 20 years, and I'm seeing more and more literature, and then also doing research in my own practice and looking at these patients and saying, wow, if certain folks are born with it, maybe Teresa was born with it, maybe it was a choice. But really what oxytocin receptor gene codes for is a bunch of skills, social skills, emotional regulation skills, interpersonal skills. And those are all things that the rest of us can learn. And then I realized, you know, I'm already doing a lot of this in my practice, is teaching people skills. So how do we find out what else these folks have and then codify it and then make it accessible to the general public?
That's really great. And you really wonder, how do you stay grounded in optimism when real adversity happens, like grief or serious health issues or a job loss? There's times when optimism can almost feel impossible. And in your book, you identify these 8 pillars to building this practical optimism.
Having at least a general idea of what are all the different pillars that contribute to optimism, so that you can sort of get an overview. And then in the beginning of the book, in the earlier chapter, I have a 40 question quiz that I don't tell you, you know, how it maps to the 8 pillars, but it does. And at the end of the quiz, you'll see how you score. And then I sort of give a key of like which, you know, questions, each, there are 8 pillars, 40 questions, each of the 5 questions maps to a particular pillar. And then it kind of gives you a sense of, wow, okay, now I get it. This is what it means to be strong in this one area. This is where I might have a blind spot. This is where I naturally shine. You know, for example, one of the pillars is practicing healthy habits. And there might be people who are like, I'm already doing all of this. That's amazing. But I'm really lacking on a sense of purpose, which is another pillar, you know, or vice versa. So I think it's helpful to know all of it. And I always say to people, you know, familiarize yourself with the program. Some people like to read, some people like the audiobook, which I narrated, and then come back to it, you know, right. There was a book that I received, Bob, as a teenager. It was called Wherever You Go, There You Are. And it was, it's by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And a friend of mine had given it to me. And it literally has stayed by my bedside for decades. And it was one of those books that I just kept returning to at different times of my life. Very simple to read, just a couple of pages per topic about not judging yourself, about compassion. And so that was my goal. I said, you know, this book has changed my life. And one day I want to do something, you know, as a gift, you know, to take all the years of knowledge and experience and training and give it back, you know, because I do think that books can hold profound wisdom and have the power to change your life. So my hope is that this book stays by your bedside in whatever form, Kindle format or hardcover, and you come back to it, because at different times of your life, you're going to struggle with different things. You know, there's a pillar on proficiency, which is, you know, this idea of self-efficacy that I can do, I have agency. And, you know, for many of us, if we're changing jobs or careers or maybe relationships, you know, haven't worked out, we start to doubt, or we're trying to lose weight and it hasn't worked out. So, you know, that is that idea of how to rebuild or build for the first time if you're working with a teenager or young person in your life, how to build agency. So I think different pillars will speak to you depending on what you're going through.
Okay, so the 8 pillars to practical optimism. The first pillar is sense of purpose, how to connect with your purpose and come up with authentic goals that energize and inspire you. Talk about that.
Yes. So I think each one of us, if we don't know what our sense of purpose is, it's our job to create it. And what I mean by that is put the cart before the horse. This is a technique called behavioral activation. And it says that a lot of times you don't feel motivated, you don't inspire. That's fine. Literally one foot in front of the other. And your purpose doesn't always have to come from your paycheck. I think there, I talk about some of the misconceptions of purpose, that your purpose has to be big or glamorous or it has to make you money or that other people have to understand it or agree with it. No. Or people think sometimes that your purpose has to remain the same throughout your life. And I say that your purpose evolves with time, just like you do. So your purpose could have been raising your kids at one point. Now your purpose is something different. You want to start a small side hustle or a small, you know, like business where you're like, oh, I want to do something, a little something for fun on the side. Or I want to take up yoga or weaving. All of these things can give you joy and meaning and pleasure. I say to people that, you know, like they may say, okay, I'm doing this job that I've been doing for so many years, but I'm not excited. Well, think about how I talk about this idea of role remake or job crafting, which, in, you know, you in the same job that you're already doing, is there a way to bring in things that excite you? So, you know, for me, I always enjoyed like speaking or writing. And when I was working at the hospital, I would be like, okay, how can I contribute to articles? How can I contribute to forums, you know, by speaking? So is there a way? I have friends who are, you know, marathon runners, and they put together runner's club at their job. And or other people who are like, I'm really social. I want to have a happy hour, you know, or mocktail hour. So think about things that you're really good at and how to infuse that into your everyday life so that you don't have to completely remake yourself, right? But it's just taking where you are and infusing more purpose and joy. I think a lot of us sometimes, especially people who are in the sandwich generation, who are in between taking care of elderly parents and young kids, which is a place where I had found myself with my mother and her declining health, you know, it can be a place where there's a lot of drudgery and, you know, monotony. And I think in caregiving also can be very, can be very draining. And so ask yourself how, you know, when is the last, like, first of all, what do I love doing? And then when was the last time I did it? And then how do I do it regularly? So, you know, I give people a million ways to connect with their purpose and why, and the fact that there's so many health benefits to it, that people who have a sense of purpose are less likely to die in the next 8 years. Even kids who have a sense of purpose by helping out, by volunteering and, you know, teaching homework to kids younger than them, those kids go on to have less obesity, less anxiety, less depression. We know that if you have a strong sense of purpose, you're less likely to have a heart attack and stroke. So kind of all of the benefits that I talked about, the health benefits for optimism, each of these eight pillars contributes and has very similar benefits about mortality, living, and living longer.
That's great. We focus so much of our lives on our work. Is there a problem with attaching your sense of purpose to your job?
I don't think that there's a problem attaching your sense of purpose to your job, but I think that it cannot be your only sense of purpose. I see so many patients who have come to see me because either they lost their job, or they got demoted, or they didn't get promoted, or they were not getting a positive review, or they were not getting promoted fast enough, and it was their only way of feeling good about themselves as a human being. So I would say, you know, I think it's amazing that if you are able to connect your purpose to your job because you're spending the majority of your waking hours there. But I would also say take up at least one hobby or activity that you shine in, that you develop and cultivate for no one else, you know, just for yourself. And, you know, if things don't work at your job, it's not like your hobby is going to, you know, change that, but it provides a little bit of a buffer and an outlet, and having a good sense of community and people that love you and support you are just reminders that you are more than your job. So I do think I get a lot of purpose from the work that I do. I don't see it as a job. I see it as a calling and a mission, and I love what I do. But I can see the trap that a person can fall in if things don't work out when you want them to work out. So I would say diversify, you know, spread those eggs in a couple more baskets.
Always a good idea. The second pillar is an important one too, processing emotions. You wrote, if I had to capture practical optimism's essence, it would be manage your emotions or they will manage you. Put simply, managing emotions is about being able to name it, claim it, tame it, and then reframe it so that our emotions can work for us as valuable feedback, helping us solve problems and enhance our relationships. To paraphrase another author and a philosopher, Dallas Willard, he said, emotions are like children. There's no doubt that they're very important, but they should never be placed in charge. you said that if we don't process our emotions. We're at their mercy. Talk about that.
Yes. So, you know, I love that quote. You know, our emotions are very important, I think, you know, pieces of information that guide us and that are in some ways physiological sensations. The information is processed simultaneously. Your heart rate is changing. You know, if it's something stressful, your breathing becomes more shallow. So think of it as a temporary, fleeting state that you observe, but you don't invest in. And if your emotions, you know, end up, let's say you're angry, like different emotions have for different people lengths of time that they can tend to linger. But if they do tend to linger, then they become a mood state. And then, you know, next thing you know, you find yourself, let's say, experiencing a depression. And the emotions carry and can influence our thoughts. And so if you're feeling sad, then all of a sudden you may start to think, if it lasts too long, you look around you and you're like, you know, I'm feeling sad, therefore the world must be, you know, a sad place. And you start to project onto your environment possibly thoughts that may not be true or may not be relevant or may not be helpful. So, you know, I think this four-step plan says, name it. What was the antecedent that caused you to feel the way that you feel? Because people who are more granular about the triggers, they always do better. Because you can, when you can pinpoint what is upsetting you in your day, someone said something to you, someone cut you off, you felt slighted, you're much more able to look at the situation and reframe it or handle it or address it head on. So name it, name the trigger, claim it. Where in the body are you feeling it? And then a lot of times we hold emotions physically. I always say that if you know, your body expresses what your mind cannot. So if you find that you get unexplained headaches or body aches, insomnia, indigestion, digestive problems, think about stress in your life and stress that you are not able to identify, right? So therefore, if you're feeling a lot of physical things, go back and name the trigger, because some people are like, I feel it in my body, but I don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. So it's so important that you tune into your emotions. What is making you upset? Who upset you? Why are you upset? Are you feeling disrespected? There's always something core. And then tame it, you know, find something, a way that you can self-soothe. It could be a 1 minute meditation. It could be a yoga practice. It could be writing in a journal. And there's a lot of benefits to writing in journals.
Your book is filled with all kinds of exercises. And I love the little practical optimist pearls of wisdom. Yes. Let's talk about this one. You don't have to believe all your thoughts.
Yes. You know, and that's, you know, what I was saying is before about that, we then get invested and we all of a sudden think, you know, the world is a scary place. And I think that, you know, in cognitive behavioral therapy, in which I was trained, in which I also went personally for my own therapy, you know, they look at this triad, negative like triad of depression, that a person thinks that like they're bad, they project onto their future, and they project onto the world. You know, so I would say be very careful when you're having negative thoughts. Say, okay, interesting. Observe them as a neutral third party would observe, and not get invested and not get attached. And I often think about negative thoughts the way I think about baggage carousel in an airport. You're going to look at other people's baggage. You might comment. You might think it's ugly. You might think it's beautiful. Oh, how nice. Look at this expensive, fancy luggage, or look at this really crummy, out of date. I feel bad for this pathetic loser who's walking around with this bag. But whatever you're thinking, you're not picking up someone's bag and taking it home with you, right? You observe it. You have thoughts about it, but you let it go. So similarly, let your thoughts, especially the negative ones, go by you without attaching yourself to them.
You have a story about a woman in your book named Nicole. Nicole, like many of us, doesn't do anger well. She often just ends up crying. Mm-hmm. Talk about how we can reframe things mm-hmm. when we get angry. How does that work?
Yeah, so I think for a lot of people, but especially women, I think anger is so powerful. And it almost, we shut down, you know, it's almost like this taboo emotion. How dare you get angry? Your anger is going to push people away. Like for any number of reasons, we're seen as unhinged when we lose our temper. I know that my kids, the new term these days by kids, it's crashing. Someone's crashing out, you know, if you raise your voice or you get angry and, you know, you're made to feel less than for having this emotion. And, you know, I think on some level, small doses of anger, you know, where it's not causing anybody harm, But to feel that, like, you know, I'm justified. I'm angry right now. And sometimes anger in small doses, right? When you're not hurting anyone, you're not hurting yourself, you're not throwing things, you're being constructive about it, adaptive about it, you know, to say, you know, I'm not happy with this. Because I know a lot of people are very angry, in, for example, in their marriages, and they don't say anything because they're so afraid of rocking the boat, disrupting the status quo. I think it's hard. I also see couples in my practice, and I think anger is a fascinating topic, because if you use it as an opportunity for connection, and it sounds so counterintuitive, I'm angry at you, why do I want to connect with you? But if you can keep the end in mind in a relationship, I'm angry, but this is a relationship that I need to foster, or I want to foster, or what outcome do I want? So always keep the outcome in mind. If the end of the day, I want to preserve this relationship, then this is what I need to do, and work backwards. You know, sometimes we tell people to, you know, screw off, whatever, and we don't keep the end in mind. And sure, if it's a stranger, you may do that, you may never see them again. But what are you really getting out of that? You know, like, at the end of the day, the anger, right, belongs to you, and you can decide. You know, it's like, I think of there's a quote that says, you know, anger is like a bitter pill or a poison that you take, hoping that it will kill someone else. So we're harming ourselves. It's like holding on to hot coal. Right? Like, it's your anger. You're holding on to it. It's damaging you. So small, healthy doses, like a hot potato, get rid of that hot potato, you know, by expressing your emotion in a constructive way without raising your voice, stating the facts, not character assassinating another person. So in the book, I talk about techniques that I use that I learned as part of my training, something called the XYZ technique, which is being very concrete about the behavior that you want to change. So in situation X, when you did Y, I felt Z. So, you know, when you say you're going to come home at 6 o'clock and relieve me of my baby duties, and you come home at 8 and you just had a cocktail and never with coworkers, and you never bothered to tell me that, I ended up feeling really disrespected and sad or whatever it is. So I'm just using that as one example, because I have a couple that I work with, and they just had a new baby, and the wife is at home, and she's like, I'm just taking care of this kid, and I don't know when I'm going to get reprieve or a break. I'm on duty 24 hours. So, you know, by not character assassinating, because I can see a situation in which the other partner, if you're not specific, can say, oh, you're just saying I'm a bad dad. Oh, you're just saying I'm a bad husband. And then it turns into, well, no, that's not what I'm saying. You know, so if you can start out from the gate, not being angry and just being very concrete when you did this, you know, so that you're not, I'm not saying you're wholly a bad person.
Very good. Very good. The third pillar is problem solving. And this pillar is about turning obstacles into opportunities. Engaging in proactive problem solving, making better decisions, and learning to let go. It's about responding, not reacting. How do we get better at doing that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's so many aspects to problem solving. One of them goes back to processing, which is managing your emotions. So anytime there's a problem in the real world, it's like a battle on two fronts. One is what's going on emotionally within me. And then the other one is concretely what's out there in the real world that needs to be managed and solved. And a lot of times we get stuck in our own head, and we perseverate and we ruminate, and we never get out there into the world to be able to make those changes, to be effective on our environment. So I gave this decision-making quiz, what's your decision-making style? Because a lot of people tend to just go in circles in their head and can't make decisions, and other people can make them very quickly. And then I give like a sort of punch list of 25 questions if you were changing careers or like jobs or you were lost. But one of the things, if you were to ask me to summarize the essence of problem solving, was something that my parents used to say to me that came from their sort of Eastern upbringing, was when you find yourself really just stuck, you know, and you've been sitting on something for days, you don't have clarity, ask yourself this question: is this a problem to be solved or a truth to be accepted? And, you know, a lot of times if we are struggling with something, it is probably because it is a truth to be accepted, and we're really having a hard time accepting it. And I think that in Western culture, the idea is you acceptance is resignation, and it's surrender, and it's a sign of weakness. And I feel like there are other parts of the world that don't see it that way. It's like, this is part of life. People age, people change, people grow apart, people die. Like, and I think that we are a very youth-obsessed, beauty, you know, wealth, like all of these things that we put focus on, and we say that your meaning, your value as a person comes from these things. And so we're always competing rather than accepting.
Yeah. Okay, the fourth pillar, pride. It's all about learning to challenge those negative thoughts that we all have. You say that you're not a fan of the concept of self-esteem, and I think you made some great points in the book explaining that. What's the problem with having high self-esteem?
Self-esteem is great as long as things are working out for you well in the world outside. So, you know, you win that game, sports game, you get an A plus on an exam, you get that promotion. And I see a lot of patients who they were superstars growing up, you know, athletes and winning awards and trophies and Ivy League schools and got their job, first job, everything worked out, right? But then when they were at that job, you know, they didn't get along with the boss or their coworkers, or they weren't liked, or any number of things. They weren't promoted. They were told they weren't doing a good job, or it was the first time in their life when things didn't work out the way that they wanted or expect, and their life had been like really good trajectory and things just kept working out for them. And this was the first time it didn't. And so when your whole life, your self-esteem is based on accolades and achievement and awards externally, the first time it happens, you really get knocked down very hard. And they came in with like depression, anxiety, who am I, what's going on? And I looked at the as therapy as the opportunity to rebuild, but instead of rebuilding with the self-esteem, because I said, you know, neither one of us has any control over your external environment. You've been lucky that you've succeeded your whole life. But I think of self-esteem as sort of weather, which it can fluctuate, you know, vastly, you know, especially if you live in the desert or by the mountains. It could be 40 degrees Fahrenheit at night, 30, and then it can be 70, 80, 90 in the daytime, right? There can be such variation, and that's what self-esteem is like. It's like the weather. Versus self-compassion, which is an inherent sense of self-worth that is based on your simple intrinsic value is resting upon the fact that you're human and you exist, period. And that is more like the climate, which is more steady and stable over time in a particular place.
And how important is it for us to accept our own imperfections, our own problems?
I think it's everything. I think it's everything. So many studies have shown that people who are self-compassionate, and you can do this by like a 5-minute journaling exercise. And I give people like prompts and also how to retrain your brain to think differently, to not beat yourself up. I think that people who have more self-compassion from head to toe, you know, you can see accelerated wound healing after a biopsy, right? You can see less aging when you look at our chromosomes and telomeres, and these are the caps of the chromosomes. There's less oxidative stress. So self-compassion will save you from a potential heart attack, even if you can make this a regular part of your life, because people who are not self-compassionate are really just very inflexible people. They're rigid. They're like, things have to work out my way. I have to be the best. I have to be perfect at all times. People are expecting a lot of me. And by no means are we saying that you should lower your standards. Not at all. Self-compassion is not at all about giving up, about taking it easy, about not showing up with your A game. And so the practical optimism is very unique in the sense that it says, keep working hard, keep trying, never give up, right? But at the same time, also course correct and accept that certain things are not going to work your way. Give yourself flexibility, give yourself time to rest, and then come back. It always suggests that you do come back, you know, and okay, maybe there's a avenue that you're not meant for. Well, you'll learn that along the way, and that's fine too.
That's great. Okay. And you can see how these pillars kind of build on each other. Pillar 5 is a proficiency. Your belief in your abilities is just as important as your actual abilities. Most of us have far more proficiency than we give ourselves credit for. So if you get passed over for a promotion, or a manager seems to give more attention to another team member, you may need to be reminded of what a capable, smart, strong human being you are. What are some good ways to build confidence and improve on our abilities?
Yes. So, you know, mentorship is a great way. And sometimes that mentor is not going to be your, you know, boss. It could be someone in a different department. It could be someone that's taken interest in you from a different company. It could have been a former boss. It could be a colleague. So, you know, people that really respect you and that see your potential and that help you see your own potential and are also invested in your growth. And it could be a 15-minute check-in, you know, like saying to someone, I know you're so super busy. Can I bring you coffee? Can I bring you lunch? So always being respectful of this other person's time and not being entitled and expect that they should just meet you. You know, I know a lot of people may, in this day and age with social media, I get this all the time where they, you know, you're getting a message from a random stranger who really isn't sensitive or in tune to your busy professional life and all that you might have going on. So, you know, just be respectful in asking for that help or mentorship. Another way I think is it's really great to go to networking conferences or meetings whenever possible for professional development, continuing to learn. And that is also a great way to meet potential mentors or people in your industry that you really value and look up to. Getting feedback is so important. Asking for feedback instead of asking for advice. So I think asking somebody like, what do you think? You know, what do you think I could do better at? Like, it's basically saying, like, is there something actionable that you can give me? And if you find that this person can't give you feedback, then say, all right, do you have any advice for me? What would you do in this situation? Because sometimes people hesitate to give feedback. They don't want to hurt your feelings. But getting feedback, even if it is from your boss, to say, like, how am I doing? Checking in, taking those opportunities to get feedback. And then vicarious learning is another one of looking at people around you. What have they done? What has worked for them? And being vulnerable, right? Because I think this is the one thing that people have a hard time doing. So many people I know, they're struggling in silence. And then they're beating themselves up. They're getting angry. They're looking at everyone. They're developing a lot of envy to be like, how come they're so ahead of the game than I am? Why do they keep getting opportunities? Instead of humbling themselves and saying, things are not working out for me. Can I be honest with you? Like, what do you think I could be or should be doing differently? So I feel like that's something that, like, I've always been very open to in my career, is asking for feedback or advice or anything, or just saying what has worked for you, or, you know, right now I'm struggling with this particular thing. So I think that really, you're never going to grow if you can't be open about your challenges and your struggles.
Pillar 6 is becoming present. Explore the power of focus to cut mental clutter, ward off worry, let go of ruminations, destroy distractions, and combat comparisons. You wrote that our brain's job is to keep us alive, not necessarily to ensure that we're happy. That's our job. And that's where being present comes in. Can you explain that?
Yes. And I love that you picked that, because, you know, every day we expect that I should just wake up happy. And that doesn't happen, because we're human. And our brain, it's like literally, think of like a vacuum cleaner that's like sucking up everything it can find on the floor, or like, you know, think of like an octopus or some animal, sea creature with tentacles that's always grabbing on to something else. And I think that, you know, a lot of times people start their day, let's say, with social media, right? So what does that do? What are your inputs? Think of social media or media as your diet, right? Would you be consuming a diet completely full of trash? And, you know, and that trash could be negative news media consumption first thing in the morning or last thing at night. It could be looking at other people's social media feeds and looking at other people on fabulous vacations or whatever it is, or ahead of your career, or maybe it could be LinkedIn and you're looking at everybody, you know, they're presenting at this conference, this person is getting a raise or promotion, or this person, you know. So the comparisons, I talk about these three things that keep us trapped, right? Like regret in the past, comparisons in the present, and worry in the future. And where do you find yourself most lost and addressing that area? And I talk about, you know, different ways, something called an oasis moment, which could be 5 minutes, shutting your office door, or, you know, if you're working from home, your door, and just breathing. You know, it's as simple as that.
Yeah, I think you wrote too that when we focus on the gap between who we are and who we think we should be, mm-hmm. we're no longer experiencing or enjoying the present moment. Is that right?
Yes. And, you know, it's interesting, because sometimes those comparisons aren't comparing ourselves to another person. It could be comparing ourselves to another version of ourselves that we wish that we could be, and constantly falling short. And I see this all the time. And so many people are not even aware of it, where it's like for, you know, for men, often it might be, and for women too, I would say, like outside the home where the work related stuff. And I see women often beating themselves like, I'm not a good enough parent because I'm managing so many different things. And that tendency to second guess. So, you know, finding joy and accomplishment and meaning in what you've already accomplished. And something that I talk about is this idea of a reverse bucket list. So we've all heard of a bucket list, which is like, okay, what do I want to do in the future? And we usually think of like travel or, I don't know, bungee jumping, skydiving, you know, depending on how adventurous you are, whitewater rafting, or I want to go to the Amalfi Coast. That's on my bucket list, or, you know, whatever it might be. And it's usually like fun and upbeat and once in a lifetime things I want to try. But this concept of a reverse bucket list is this idea of, what have I already accomplished that I'm already grateful for and proud of? And I think that, you know, this idea that you're only as good as your last project, I think in today's society, we are made to feel as we're only as good as our next project. Because whenever I meet people, they're like, oh, and now what are you working on, right? When's the next book coming out? And I'm like, calm down, you know, like this one was a lot of work. It was a lot of research, you know, and I think of it as kind of, like if a new mom, like this happens, I see this a lot, like a new mom is holding her baby and already she's getting questions. When's the next one coming? And she's like, I'm staying up late with this 3-month-old.
Okay, pillar 7. I think this is so important. People, reduce loneliness, create new friendships, cultivate a sense of belonging, joy, and satisfaction in our connections, both at home and at work. Social media, you mentioned it, often amplifies this fake happiness. How can we build a more authentic sense of optimism in a world that is full of filters and comparison?
Yes. So I think the key component is, there are a few things. One is intentionality, right? Like looking at your social life as a medical prescription for good health. And what I mean by that is the quality of your health, your life, your relationships, it is all determined by the investment that you put in those relationships now. And if someone were to say, you know, a lot of us think like, what am I going to be like in my 70s and 80s? Well, take a snapshot of what your friendships look like in your 30s, 40s, and 50s, because that is going to predict your health. The quality of your life is determined by the quality of your relationships. We know that people who are experiencing subjective feelings of loneliness, so not necessarily has anything to do with the quantity of people in your life, but rather the quality. Do you feel seen and heard? Do you feel like you're connecting? Do you feel like this person has your back? People who are experiencing subjective loneliness, it's the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day in terms of the health detriments. People who are lonely more likely to die, you know, in the next decade, 50% more likely to have heart attacks and strokes. So there really is, there's real damage, physical damage. We literally wither away. So to me, it starts with an intentionality of, the doctor has given me a prescription. You know, I literally prescribe my patients. I'm like, I want you to have authentic connection at least once a week and as much as possible in person. And part of that means following up with the other person, making, like, there's a quote that I love by Dale Carnegie, who had written, you know, How to Win Friends and Influence People, How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. And I grew up with a house full of books from all different disciplines. And, you know, this, my dad had one of the earlier copies, and I loved, he said that you will get more friends by being interested in other people in 2 months than you would in 2 years trying to be interesting. So instead, flip the switch, talk less, listen more, ask questions, follow up with people. You mentioned that vacation you went on. You mentioned your mom wasn't feeling well. You mentioned your kids are applying to college. Take note of what are the salient points or struggles or conflicts or challenges in a person's life, and follow up on them. And you can go one step. I say, you know, the difference between empathy and compassion is empathy in action. So empathy is like feeling for someone, like, you know, versus compassion is like rolling up your sleeve and it's like, I feel for you, but I also want to help you. And I feel like we've lost community in recent years, and people are busy with work and achievement and taking care of their families, that built-in layer of support and also micro connections, right? Like talking to the barista or the dog walker, like all of those things. Really do benefit our mental health. And so does talking to strangers. And I think that a lot of folks, I see a lot of young people walking around with headphones, which basically says, do not disturb. And then they wonder why they're lonely, right? Because you are saying, don't talk to me. So think about how you can make yourself more approachable, smiling, making eye contact, saying somebody's name several times in the first few minutes of talking to them. Say, repeating the, there are certain tricks, you know, like saying the last word that they just said, which says, I'm listening to you, I'm hearing you, I'm incorporating your language into what I'm saying, mirroring somebody's facial expressions and reactions, matching their energy, being enthusiastic when you see them. It's a little bit of work, but I can tell you that the payoff, like 100 times, you know, exponential reward for investing in relationships.
That's awesome. Okay, pillar 8, practicing healthy habits. You wrote about practice the 4 M's of mental health: mastery, movement, meaningful engagement, and mindfulness. Talk real briefly about each one and why they matter so much to our mental health.
Yeah, so mastery, you don't have to be a master to experience mastery. Simply spend 10 or 15 minutes a day on something that you want to get better at, simply for the sake of getting better at. This could be anything. This could be golfing. This could be, you know, cooking, learning new recipes, needlepoint, like anything. But when you're in the flow state, which is what happens when you're experiencing total immersion with an activity, your brain simply doesn't have the capacity to wander off and ruminate about all the worries in your life. It's incompatible. So pick something that you're really good at and use your focus for good instead of being stuck in your own head. And there's a sense of pride that comes with that. Meaningful engagement, just what I talked about, you know, once a week, investing, asking someone else, being vulnerable, micro connections, making more of an effort to have those small talk. Small talk is just as important as big talk, but make sure you do both and put your phone away when you're talking to people. Just the mere sign of a phone on a table implies that the conversation is not going to go deep, and that you're likely to be getting interrupted. Movement, we're now finding so much value to walking instead of 10,000 steps a day, 4,000, 5,000, 7,000 for both heart health and also preventing depression and anxiety. So the 4,000 to 5,000 to 7,000, totally achievable. If not, if you can do, you know, that plus strength training, there's a lot of information showing that muscles release important chemicals into the body that boost your mood. BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, they secrete a lot of chemicals that can actually improve your mood from strength training. And also it'll help boost your longevity and also preventing dementia. We see a direct correlation between muscles in your legs and the size and density and how that's related to less cognitive decline. So it's very interesting, but brain and body, totally very connected. In mindfulness, oasis moments, spending 1 to 2 minutes, closing your eyes, shutting off the rest of the world, and breathing.
Very good. So those are the 8 pillars, and there's a lot more of really great information about each of those pillars in Dr. Varma's books. Let's say everybody reads your book. Everybody goes out and buys your book. They read it. They start practicing it. What does a culture of practical optimism look like in workplaces, schools, or in families? Can it actually shift group dynamics, not just individual well-being?
Absolutely. You know, and that is my hope, that it can shape our culture to be kinder, to be more compassionate, to be more action-oriented, and to have a sense of shared responsibility. I think that we, in some places, have shifted more to this very hyper-individualism, individualistic culture of, you know, I, me, mine. And, you know, one thing that I was raised on is this idea of, you know, it's not just going from being in a state of being dependent when you're a kid, dependent, to independent as an adult, right? I feel like that seems obvious to the outside person. Yes, you're a child, you're dependent on your parents, you grow up and you become independent. But there's this idea of not just independent, but interdependent and eventually dependable. So I do feel that we have a responsibility to other people, and to not see that, right, we're totally missing the mark. I think on some levels with this, I love the fact that more people are talking about mental health on social media, but we have to make sure that the pendulum doesn't swing so far, right, that we cut off people, cut off relationships, that, you know, the message of therapy was about healing, and the point was to strengthen bonds and relationships, right, not to distance yourself off, which I'm seeing a lot of you know, people in the younger generation do. So I think awareness is important, but it is in service of others. And I think that practical optimism can just help us be better, kinder human beings.
Right. So as we close, as much as we all want to be optimistic, some listeners might just feel like they're stuck in negativity or hopelessness. What's one message that you'd want them to take away from this conversation?
I've seen it all. You know, if you're going to tell me about hopelessness, I've experienced it. I have seen it. I've gone through my own ups and downs, and I've worked with thousands of people and talked to many, many more through the public work that I do. And I can say that I hear you. I see you. I can understand where the hopelessness may come from. And I know that you might have had, you know, a hard life, or maybe you're going through a hard time right now. But I do think, I do believe that through your perceptions of the world, right, you can influence the outcomes. And really, that's what practical optimism is about, is that it is shaping and turning positive outlooks into positive outcomes. So know that anytime you walk into a room and that you expect people to be friendly towards you, you expect things, good things to happen from that, they will, because you are showing up with a smile, being kind, being open, being approachable. So your entire way of relating to the world is influenced by the thoughts that you carry with you. So choose them wisely.
You mentioned your dad. I want to end our conversation talking about him. You said that he is a living example of practical optimism. He embraces the fact that we can't stop the waves of life, but we can learn to surf. I love that. Dr. Sue Varma, thank you so much.
Thank you. What a pleasure. Thank you so much. This was such a great conversation. Thank you for having me, and thank you for taking the time to read the book and really understand and relate to it. Very grateful.
The book is Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being by Dr. Sue Varma. As we wrap up this episode, my hope is that this conversation leaves you feeling just a little more empowered, a little bit more optimistic, if you will. Whether it's about checking in with yourself, building a new habit, or simply being a bit more compassionate with your own mental health journey, Dr. Varma reminded us that practical optimism isn't just a trait. It's an approach that takes practice, like yoga. As she says in her book, it's like building muscles. It takes daily workouts. Sometimes it's 5 minutes a day, sometimes longer, but it's a muscle worth exercising because, honestly, it can change your life. If today's topic resonated with you, you might want to check out Dr. Varma's book for yourself, Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being. You can learn more at Dr. Varma's website, drsuevarma.com. You'll also find her on Instagram, Facebook, X, and LinkedIn. Straight Talk for Real Life is produced by HPE. Just a reminder, if you're an HPE team member, please remember that there are many resources available to you and your family members that can help you learn and explore more about your well-being so that you're more in control no matter what life throws your way. It's all available through the HPE Global Wellness Program. If you're an HPE team member outside the U.S., you'll find those resources on the Global Wellness page. And if you're in the U.S., you'll find them on myhperewards.com. Our thanks to Dr. Sue Varma for her insights today. And as always, thank you so much for being here and listening. Until next time, take good care of yourself, stay optimistic, and let's talk again soon.